Well, good afternoon and good morning all, and welcome to the third teleclass in our Novice series. Today is How to Become Certified Without Becoming Certifiable, Preparing for the CIC Exam. My name is Paul Weber, and I am really pleased that you've joined what I think will certainly be a very interesting and instructive hour. Many, many, many moons ago, when I first met Sue Cooper, she had just moved from a lab specialist position into infection prevention and control, and I must say that I liked her right away. In fact, you really can't help but like Sue. She's the kind of person you want to have working with you or serving on your planning committee because she's really bright, she's sincere, she works extremely hard, and she is an incredibly talented educator. And on top of that, she's a really nice person. At present, Sue is a consultant educator for the Southeastern Ontario Infection Control Network, and it's that role that I think fits her better than any she's had before. I don't know how many people have been coached by Sue to successfully passing their CIC exam, but it's way more than a handful, and she's done exceptionally well. So I'm really pleased that she's able to give this presentation today, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I'll let her get to it. So to present How to Become Certified Without Becoming Certifiable from the Southeastern Ontario Infection Control Network in Kingston, Ontario, Canada, I am delighted to present my friend Susan Cooper. Sue.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's a good thing I'm alone in the room here because you're making me blush. When Paul asked me to do this teleconference for him, first of all, I thought, why me? And then I thought, well, why not me? Because as Paul said, we've had quite a bit of success in this part of the country in helping people get certified. When I took on this role about almost 4 years ago now, we had four people in our area who were certified, and I think we're up over 20 now. So we're quite happy with that. And the first thing Paul asked me to do was put together some objectives. So if you'd move to the first slide, which is titled Objectives, funny enough, I sat down and I came up with some objectives and I sent them off to Paul, and then when I got looking at them I thought, wow, those are pretty ambitious objectives. I really hope we have enough time to get through all of this stuff today. We'll certainly try as much as we can. And hopefully when we're finished you'll feel a little more comfortable about the process of becoming certified. Myself got certified about 3 years ago, early 2007, and so I'm now starting to think about having to recertify in the next year or so. So some of the things we're going to talk about today are we're going to talk about why you need to get certified, why it's important to be certified in infection control. We'll talk about what you need to be doing or to have accomplished to become eligible to certify. Not everybody can become certified in infection control. We'll talk about when you should get certified and when you need to recertify, because unlike many things, certification in infection control requires you to recertify every 5 years. Talk a bit about the resources that you need to help you get ready to get certified, introduce you to the actual process of applying for the exam and writing the exam. And there have been some recent changes, and one of my friends, I'm pleased to call her my friend, is Sharon Christofiak, who is the past president of the Certification Board, and she's done a couple presentations for me. And the last time I talked to Sharon, she talked to me about some of the changes that have happened over the last year in certification. So we'll talk about those, and we'll also review some of the hints and tips that you need that maybe help make the process a little easier for you. So if you'd like to move to the next slide, we're going to talk about why you need to get certified. Basically, there's an increased awareness of the significance of certification. Certainly, in Canada, SARS opened a lot of our eyes to some of the things that we needed to get put in place around infection control. In the U.S., the Joint Commissions on Accreditation endorses certification with the Certification Board for people who are involved in infection control. It gives you some validation to your knowledge. Certification in any area actually signifies that you have a certain level of knowledge and expertise. So certification in infection control is no different than anything else. Right now, there are certified ICPs in 24 countries. I went onto the CIBIC website, And I pulled off all the countries and counted them up. And it's amazing that some of the countries that have certified people practicing infection control, aside from the U.S. and Canada, which obviously have the most numbers, there's China, Hong Kong, Malaysia, India, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, New Zealand, Australia, England. Worldwide, there are people who hold this certification. And this certification indicates that you have a certain mastery of the role of infection control. An editorial that was published in the American Journal of Infection Control back in April of 2007 talked about the CIC certification and why it should be a global priority. And that's a really good document. And I will actually send it to Paul so he can post it on the website so people can access that if they want it. This certification, like I mentioned, is recognized internationally. In many countries, throughout the world, CIC is recognized as a standard for infection control practitioners. And just the personal satisfaction of becoming certified is important as well. So if you want to move on to the next slide, when you write this exam, the Certification Board of Infection Control exam, it allows you to use the designation CIC following your name. There is nothing else out there, no course that you can take, nothing that allows you to use that designation. You might take a course that gives you a certificate in infection control when you're finished, but it does not allow you to use the designation CIC after your name. You must write the exam through the certification board to be allowed to use that designation. Once you become certified, your certification is valid for 5 years. And at the end of that 5 years, you have to recertify. Again, I want to emphasize the fact that there are lots of courses out there. In Canada, we have courses. There's courses in the States. There's courses through APIC, through a lot of other organizations. And they all may give you a certificate that you can hang on your wall, but it does not give you the authority or it does not allow you to use the term CIC, the designation CIC, after your name. Only passing this exam gives you recognized certification in infection control. And if you want to move to the next slide, we're going to talk a bit about the Certification Board, or CIBIC as we like to call it, the Certification Board of Infection Control and Epidemiology, or CBIC. This is an independent organization. It is not connected to CHICA. It's not connected to APIC. It's not connected to any other organization. It is an independent body on its own. It has a multidisciplinary international board of directors. There are many people sitting on the board, both from the U.S. and Canada, and everybody who sits on that board must be certified in infection control. And this is a group of people that actually develop and administer the exam. They develop the content, they create the questions, and they're the ones that administer this exam. And as you see on this slide, they have a website, which is www.cbic.org. And I really encourage you to check out the website because it's got a lot of very valuable information on it. So if you want to move to the next slide, the program that CIBIC, I'm going to use the term CIBIC, it's easier for me, but the Certification Board program is accredited by the National Commissions for Certifying Agencies in the United States. It is recognized by both APIC and CHICA as being the body to provide this certification. CIBIC has hired a company called AMP, Applied Measurement Professionals, and they're the company that actually administers the exam, does the marking of the exam and what have you. So when you go to apply for the exam, you'll actually go to the AMP website. CIBIC develops the content, but AMP actually monitors the exam, provides the exam, processes the exam, and then sends everything back to CIBIC. We're going to talk a little bit more about AMP in a few slides. So if you want to move to the next slide, what I did here was I just took a screenshot of the CIBIC website. Like I say, it's got a lot of really valuable information on it. It's got all sorts of information about how to get certified, who can get certified, what the process is, what you need to go through. It's got a lot of other things on there. There's products that they put out. There's links to important other websites. They actually put out an e-newsletter every couple of months that you can access there as well. So it's a really valuable website. Most people that I know who are involved in infection control actually have this website bookmarked so that they can go back to it again and again. It's a really well laid out website, and it's got information on just about anything you would need to know about becoming certified. So if you want to move to the next slide, what I put on here was, and I took this directly off the website, is the mission statement of the Certification Board of Infection Control. And that is to improve the quality of healthcare by increasing the number of professionals whose knowledge, mastery in infection control and applied epidemiology has been demonstrated by certification. And CIBIC truly believes that certification is in the best interest of both the public and of the profession. If you are certified, it indicates you have a certain amount of knowledge in the field of infection control. Both the mission statement and the value statements are available on the certification website if you want to look at it a little bit more closely. So if you move to the next slide just has a list of the people who are involved in the certification board. This is their board of directors. And like I mentioned earlier, it is a multidisciplinary board. It's a voluntary board. People are not paid to be on this board. And it is autonomous. They rule themselves. They do not answer to any other organization. It is comprised of nurses from various settings. There is a physician, a medical technologist or clinical microbiologist. There is a Canadian representative. There is an education representative, a consumer representative, a representative from APIC, and a representative from CHIC Canada. And it is usually the CHIC Canada president that is that representative. And all of the members, including the physician, must be certified in infection control. And actually, I happen to know that the physician currently on the CIBIC board is Dr. Kathy Sue from Ottawa, and she does hold certification in infection control. A complete list of the directors, including all of their contact information, is also available on the website if you ever want to contact any of them. So if you go to the next slide, we're going to talk about the eligibility requirements. And I said a little earlier that not everybody can write this exam. Just because you have an interest in infection control doesn't mean you can go out and pick up some books and study and then write this certification exam and then go looking for a job in infection control. There are educational requirements and there is a practice requirement, and you must meet both of these eligibility requirements before you will be allowed to write the exam. Both of these are clearly defined, the eligibility requirements, in the handbook that we're going to talk about in a few slides. But we're going to also review them a little bit over the next few slides. It's important to note that if you are currently certified and you let your certification lapse, meaning you do not recertify at the end of 5 years, then you must start the process all over again and you must meet the eligibility requirements to be able to write the exam again. So if you move to the next slide, we'll talk first about the educational requirements to become certified. So you must hold a current license or registration as a medical technologist, a physician, a registered nurse, or you must have a minimum of a baccalaureate degree. Now, I've got put on here that says an education waiver is available. If you do not meet these education requirements, for example, I know certainly in Ontario, there are some long-term care facilities that have an RPN doing their infection control, and they do not hold a license as a registered nurse. However, they can submit an education waiver to the certification board, and they will actually look at their education, look at their background, and determine whether they're eligible to write the exam or not. It costs you $30 U.S. to submit this education waiver, but if you feel you meet the practice requirements but you don't have the educational requirements, you can submit this waiver and hope that they will allow you to go ahead and write the exam. If you go to the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about the practice requirements. And the first thing I wanted to emphasize with the practice requirements is There is no waiver for the practice requirements. You must meet them. You can't submit a waiver and get them waived to allow you to write the exam. You must actually be employed in the field of infection prevention and control, and your job responsibilities and tasks must include specific activities, and we're going to talk about these activities briefly over the next couple of slides. There is a complete detailed list of activities in the handbook and also on the Certification Board website. So if you want to move to the next slide, we're going to talk about the required activities. So job responsibilities and tasks must include both of analysis and interpretation of data and investigation and surveillance of suspected outbreaks. Now, some of what you're doing in your job, you may not call it surveillance or you may not call it analysis of data, but if you sit back and look at it, it may very well be. Chances are that if infection control is part of the job that you're practicing, you're going to have be doing some of these things, even though you may not call it that. For example, I had someone from a long-term care facility call me, and she said, well, I'm not really doing surveillance. And I asked her a couple of questions, and they were, okay, if you have a couple of residents that have loose stools, have diarrhea, and then you go and say to the staff, we need to keep an eye on the rest of the people, the rest of the residents on that wing, and if anybody else develops symptoms, let me know. Well, you know what? That's surveillance. That's keeping an eye on what's going on in the facility. So you may not call it surveillance, but it probably is surveillance. And analysis and interpretation of data is basically you keep track of what's going on, and you're able to communicate that to other people. So a lot of that is really, although it's got quite a formal title to it, it may not be as formal as in what you're doing in your role every day. And if you go to the next slide, you must meet both of those that we just talked about and at least three of the following: planning and implementation and evaluation of infection prevention and control measures. Do you have a hand hygiene program in your facility? If you do, are you auditing it? Have you got signage up at the doors asking visitors not to come in if they're sick? That type of thing would fit into this category. Education of individuals about infection risk, prevention and control. In services, orientation, are you involved in any of that? That's education. The development and revision of infection control policies and procedures. Do you have a manual, an infection control manual? Do you have infection control policies? Do you help write them? Do you help update them? That would all fit in under that category. The management of infection prevention and control activities, well, that's on a day-to-day basis. If you have infection control as part of the hat that you wear, then you're probably doing this. And the provision of consultation on infection risk assessment, prevention, and control strategies. Are you the go-to person? Are you the person that they call when there's a problem? If you've got three patients or three residents with diarrhea, are you the person that they get in touch with and say, what are we supposed to do now? That would be considered consultation on that. So those are all things that if you sit back and you go through a detailed list, you probably meet most of those, again, if you have infection control as part of your role in your facility. So if you go to the next slide, there have been some recent major changes in the way that the exam is run. Up until recently, there was a 2-year practice requirement for the exam, and that meant that you had to have been practicing those things that we talked about over the last couple of slides for at least 2 years to be allowed to write the exam. They actually changed that in 2009. They eliminated the requirement that you have a minimum of 2 years. However, it's important to recognize the fact that actual practice in the field of infection control is required. You have to actually be practicing infection prevention and control to write the exam. And the content of the exam is still based on a person who has actively practiced infection prevention and control for at least 2 years. So you can't just start the job today and expect to have the knowledge you need to write the exam in the next week or the next month or even the next 6 months. You really need to have been practicing the role of infection control for a while before you're going to have the basic knowledge and understanding that you need to write this exam. All the exams are computer-based. There used to be a paper exam that you could sit down and write. No, that is no longer. They're all computer-based, including the what we call the SARE, or the self-assessment recertification exam, I believe it is. It used to be an open book take-home paper that you could spend time working on. It is still open book, and you can still work on it over a period of time, but it is computer-based now as well. They've also done what they call a practice analysis. And a practice analysis is basically a survey of people involved in the field of infection prevention and control to see actually what their role is, to see what they're actually doing in their roles nowadays. Because as we all know, infection prevention and control has changed dramatically over the last few years. So they want to make sure that the questions they're asking and the knowledge that they're testing for is actually what's happening in the field of infection prevention and control these days. The previous practice analysis was completed in 2005-2006, and the exam was changed, the content was changed to reflect that practice analysis. There was another one done in 2009, and the exam has been updated, and the syllabus of study, or the outline, the content of the exam has been changed, and that new exam will be launched in July of this year with the new content. Auditing of candidates, pre-auditing of candidates. I can't tell you what went on prior to the year 2000 because I wasn't involved in infection prevention and control. However, I can tell you over the last few years, when you submitted an application for the exam, they looked at your educational requirements, they looked at your practice requirements, and if they looked good on paper, then they let you go ahead and write the exam. What they did afterwards was they randomly audited people who had written and passed the exam and asked them to prove that they were actually doing infection control by getting a letter from their employer or something similar to that. They had to actually prove that they met the requirements, and that was done randomly. I have a couple of colleagues in this area who actually were audited post-exam, but most of us were not. They just took what we had on paper and assumed we were telling the truth. They're not doing that anymore. What they are now doing is they're actually going to ensure that people meet the requirements prior to them writing the exam. And I believe this is going to be launched in July as well. I could be wrong on that, but I believe that's what I was told, that this will be launched in July as well, that they will actually audit people before they write the exam, rather than have someone spend a lot of time, write the exam, potentially pass the exam, and then not meet the requirements. Then what do they do? Well, they can't give them certification if they don't meet the requirements. So they're going to do that prior to people writing the exam. So those are the major changes that have happened over the last year or so, and most of them will go into effect this year. So if you want to move to the next slide, we'll talk a little bit about AMP, or Applied Measurement Professionals. And this is an organization that the certification board that CIBIC has hired, and they manage their exam and their exam process for them. CIBIC creates the content. AMP does not create the content. However, they have staff called psychometric staff, and I'll be honest, I had to look up what the term psychometric meant. And it's basically a field of study concerned with the theory and techniques of educational and psychological measurement. So they have actual experts that look at the questions, make sure the questions flow properly, that they're not ambiguous, that there's not a real obvious answer, that it's a good question before they use it. But the certification board actually develops the content. And AMP provides professional expertise on the format, on the structuring. They manage the actual testing process for them, and then they return the results back to the certification board after you have written the exam. So when you go to apply for your exam, you may access it through the certification board website, but it will send you to the AMP website, which you'll see on the slide that you're looking at. That is their website. So if you're interested in learning more about this company, you can go there and find out about them. So if you want to go to the next slide, we'll start talking a little bit about the actual exam process. because it's a little takes a little bit of time. If you decide you're ready to write the exam, you're going to need 3 or 4 weeks to actually get through the process of applying for the exam before you can actually sit down and write the exam. It is administered via computer, and they use testing sites throughout North America. I've got on this slide 140. I actually went in this morning and looked, and there's significantly more than 140 test sites in North America. There are also test sites in Argentina, Australia, Bermuda, China, the Middle East, India, England, Japan. Pretty much anywhere you are in the world, you can find a testing site that is not too far away from you. Even in South Korea, South Africa, there are testing centers there. I know in the U.S., in many cases, they're using H&R Block offices because they have secure Internet access and they have computers available to them. Tax season may not be the best time to try to schedule an exam, but throughout the rest of the year, they use H&R Block offices. I know in Ontario right now, they're using an organization called Sylvan Learning, which is an organization that provides educational support to people who are having trouble learning. They're using a lot of Sylvan Learning centers, but they're also using testing centers at some of our colleges and universities as well. There are 21 sites in Canada, and again, on the Certification Board website, if you go into their website and click on the tab that says International Testing, you can choose your country, and it will list all of the sites in your country that are available for testing. Including the U.S., as a matter of fact. Even if you're U.S.-based, if you click on that international testing site, it actually brings up the U.S. map first. So when you're ready to write your exam, there are no pre-scheduled testing dates. You will have a window of time, and when you get your letter of acceptance, they will give you a window of time in which you have to write the exam. And I believe it's 90 days from the time that you're accepted to write the exam. You have to write within that 90-day period. You will actually receive a notice from AMP that confirms your eligibility to write, and it will give you instructions on how to go about scheduling your exam and your appointment for it. So a complete list of all the testing centers is available online. So if you want to go to the next slide, and this is something I want to emphasize because we have run into some problems with it in Canada. If you are based in the U.S., you can apply for the exam online through the CIBIC website, but only if you are based in the U.S. If you are an international candidate, and an international candidate includes Canada and all other countries, you must actually go into the website, print off the application form, fill it out, and mail it or fax it back to AMP for processing. You cannot apply online if you're based anywhere outside the United States. That's important to remember. I had an email about 2 weeks ago from a colleague here in this area who'd been trying for 2 days to get her application to go through, and it kept kicking her out. And it's because she was trying to apply online from a Canadian-based site. So you cannot apply online if you're based outside of the U.S. If you want to go to the next slide, and this talks about the actual process of applying for the exam. So you either apply online or you apply via mail or by fax, and usually within 2 weeks, but it may take up to 3 weeks depending on the time of year, you will receive a notice back from AMP that you have either been accepted to write the exam or not accepted, and it will explain why you weren't if you aren't. But you will receive a confirmation of eligibility from them within that 2 to 3 week period. And if you haven't received it within the 3 weeks, call them. I have known a couple of people whose things have sort of gotten lost in the mail and they didn't realize it, and they waited and waited and waited. So if you haven't received your notification that you've been confirmed within 3 weeks, call them and find out whether they have received it and what the status is on it. And again, once you receive your confirmation of eligibility, you have 90 days to schedule your exam and write your exam. Once that 90-day period has expired, unless there are extenuating circumstances and you contact them and they approve it, you lose that application fee and you have to start the process all over again and pay again. And it's not cheap. It's in the neighborhood of $350 Canadian. I believe it's very close to that amount U.S. So it's not cheap. So don't send your application in if you don't feel you're going to be ready to write within 90 days, because you will lose your money if you don't write within that period. If you go to the next slide, so how do you actually schedule your exam? You can schedule the minute you get that confirmation. You can go ahead and schedule the exam as soon as you want to write, or anytime within that 90-day period. Again, if you're based in the U.S., you can schedule your appointment online. You can go into the website, and your confirmation of eligibility will give instructions on how to do that, on how to actually go ahead and schedule your exam. If you're an international candidate, you cannot schedule online. When I wrote three and a half years ago, I actually had to call them, and we scheduled it over the phone. Now, I recently spoke to a colleague of mine who wrote recently. Because of where we happen to be located in Canada, we're very close to the U.S. border. We're actually right on the St. Lawrence River. And a lot of people in this area choose to go to the States to write their exam. And I had a colleague who fairly recently did that, and I contacted her and I said, you had to apply as an international candidate, but then when you scheduled your exam, because you were writing in the States, were you able to schedule online? And she said, yes, she was. Because she was writing at a U.S.-based testing center, she was able to schedule online. So if you happen to be writing at a U.S.-based testing center, it looks as though you can schedule it online, even if you live outside of the U.S. So if you want to go, again, a complete list of the testing centers is available on their website. You can take a look even before you apply and try to figure out where it is you want to write. There are fairly strategically placed centers throughout Canada, throughout the U.S., and certainly internationally as well. If you want to go to the next slide, we'll talk about the initial certification exam. And I mentioned earlier that there's an initial exam and then there's a recertification exam. And we're going to focus primarily on the initial certification exam. This is a 150-question multiple-choice exam. There are two versions, so if you have two people in the same room, they may or may not have the same exam come up on the computer. There are two different versions. The questions are similar or maybe the same, but in a different order. But there are two different versions of the exam. As I mentioned, it's 150 multiple-choice questions. Of those 150 questions, 15 are what they call test questions. They're questions that they're not quite sure whether they work, or they want to see if it's testing for the right information, or if it's too difficult or not difficult enough, or they may be questions that they want to use in a future exam and they just want to see how they work. So when you write your exam, although you answer 150 questions, you actually will receive a mark out of 135. Those 15 test questions are not marked as part of your final score. However, you don't know which 15 questions it is that they're not marking. So you have to assume that all 150 questions are questions that are going to be marked, because there's no way to know which 15 it is that are not going to be marked. A passing mark is somewhere around 70%. They give you a mark out of 135 that they expect you to reach, and you'll get that when you get your results. They will give you what they consider the passing mark. It's somewhere around 94, 95 out of 135. It is a proctored computer-based exam, which means that there will be someone watching you so that you can't cheat on the exam. Not that it would be easy to cheat anyway, but there will be somebody keeping an eye on you when you're writing this exam. And the questions, the 150 questions, were developed from the job analysis that was sent out in the U.S. and Canada over the last few years. So if you want to go to the next slide, we're going to talk very briefly about recertification. Once you become certified, you must recertify every 5 years. And you can do it two different ways. you have the option of either taking the initial computer-based exam again, or you can do what they call the Self-Achievement Recertification Exam, or the SAR as we call it. If you do the SAR, you have a full year to do it. You can purchase the exam early in the year. It is computer-based. You will be given an access code to the exam. You can go in and out of it as many times as you want. You can change your answers. You can use books to research the answers. It's more a more difficult exam. It requires a little bit more knowledge, a little bit more of putting into practice your assessment skills, that type of thing. And you have the full year to do it. It has to be submitted by, I believe, the 31st of December in the year that your certification runs out. So, for example, my certification expires in 2012. So by December 31st, 2012, I will either have to have applied for and gone and written the initial computer-based exam again, or I will have had to do the Self-Achievement Recertification Exam, one or the other, by December 31st of that year. The SAR was, until the last year or so, was a paper exam. You sent in your money and they actually sent you a test booklet and you had the period of time to work on it, and then you sent it back in and it was scored. That is no longer available. The SAR is now computer-based. You, again, like I say, you're sent an access code. You can access the exam as often as you want. You can do a question a day, or you can do it however you want to do it. And once you're finished, hit submit, and it's submitted. And from talking to people who've done it recently, as soon as you submit it, you get your result, which is good. You're not left waiting for any period of time. You get your result right away. CIBIC does not believe that continuing education demonstrates competence, and that's why they want you to recertify. They want you to actually sit the exam and actually prove that you have the knowledge base that you need to hold certification in infection control. So if you go to the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about actually taking the exam. When you actually get there to take the exam, what's going to happen? Well, first thing that's going to happen is they're going to ask you for two forms of identification. One of them must have a current photograph on it. It can be a driver's license, a passport, your ID card from your employer, anything that's got a current a picture of you on it. And then you must have a second form of identification to support that. It must be in your current name, and it must have a signature on it. So there's a list of things. Once you're sent your package, there's a list of things that it will tell you that are acceptable forms of identification. If you appear without identification, you will not be allowed to write the exam. If you go to the next slide, the exam itself, like I said, is 150 multiple choice questions, and you have 3 hours to complete this exam. If you write it at a U.S.-based exam center, you will receive a pass or fail notice before you leave the office. You submit the exam. Speaking to people who've written it in the States, they said they hit submit, they packed up their whatever they had in front of them, their calculator, their pencil, whatever they had with them, put on their coat, and as they were leaving the office, they were handed a piece of paper that said pass or fail on it. If you write at an international testing center, including the Canadian testing centers, your marks will arrive in the mail, and they say within 2 to 3 weeks. Now, I can tell you, when I wrote on a Monday, and I had my results the following Wednesday, so it was about 10 days. Most people, it's taking between 10 days and 2 weeks, but they say within 3 weeks you will get your results in the mail. And that's why a lot of people who are close to the U.S. want to go to a U.S. testing center. It sort of doesn't keep you on pins and needles for 2 or 3 weeks. You actually know as soon as you write the exam whether you've passed or not. And that can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing. I've spoken to people who've had a wonderful trip home, and other people who literally were in tears all the way home because they were not successful in the exam. So it just depends on your preference and what you want to do. If we move to the next slide, these are just some tips about when you're taking the test. Get there in plenty of time. If you are more than 15 minutes late, even if you have everything you need, you will not be allowed to write the exam. So you need to get there in lots of time. Don't cut yourself short. If you're making the trip to get to a testing site, make sure you've left yourself time for weather or for traffic or whatever else you need to, because if you're more than 15 minutes late, they've been told they are not to allow you to write the exam. You cannot take any personal items into the room with you. You are allowed a calculator, but it can't be programmable. You can take a pen or a pencil, but you can't take any paper in with you. Wherever you're writing the exam, we'll supply you with some scratch pads, some scrap paper to write on, but you must return it to them at the end of the exam. What they don't want people writing down questions and taking them out and sharing them with other people. So you can't take anything into the room with you except a pen or a pencil and your a non-programmable calculator, and you can't take anything out of the room with you except those things as well. If you go to the next slide, again, this is more about the questions. As we said, there's 150 multiple choice questions. All of the questions must fit into a category that's on the content outline, and we'll talk about the content outline in a little bit. They've tried to eliminate any questions that have negative wording, you know, questions like never or all of the above except, that type of thing. They've tried to eliminate all of those types of questions. There may still be the odd one come through, but for the most part, they've tried to get rid of those questions. They've tried to get rid of questions that have, you know, you'll have choices A, B, C, and D, and your answers are A and B, or A and C, or A, B, and C, or D only, or that type of thing. They've tried to get rid of those as well. They have removed all nation-specific references. They don't refer to any specific group, the Joint Commissions in the U.S. or in Canada. They don't talk about Accreditation Canada or any of those things. They've tried to remove national-specific references whenever possible. All of the questions are based on North American practice. So if you're writing outside of North America, you need to be aware of the guidelines and the standards in North America, because that's what the exam is based on. There are no trick questions. They don't want people to fail. They want people to be successful. So they've tried to get rid of trick questions as well. They're trying to use well-constructed questions following normal rules of grammar that clearly states the question, that avoids negative wording, uses clear and simple language, and they've tried to eliminate anything that's irrelevant as well. So they've tried to simplify it as well, as much as possible. So if you go to the next slide, we'll talk a bit about it, taking the exam again. When you actually sit down at your computer, you will be given the opportunity to practice. There are some practice questions that once you log in or they log in for you, there are some practice questions that will come up. And you can take some time and actually go through these practice questions just so that you're familiar with the actual way that the questions are set up, with what you need to do to advance to the next question or to go back to the previous question or to submit your answer, that type of thing. Take some time. Make sure you take some time and that you actually go through this and that you're comfortable with the way it's set up. The time that you use is not counted as part of your 3 hours. Your 3 hours will start once you've finished your practice questions and you indicate that you're actually moving into the exam. That is when your 3 hours will start. So make sure you're comfortable with the computer, with the mouse, with anything else that you need to before you actually start your timed portion of the exam. If you're having problems, make sure you tell the proctor that's there, and they can perhaps help you. I've spoken to a couple of people who've had internet problems, and they've been able to solve them for them, or they've been able to work around them. So make sure you tell the proctor if you're having any problems. You have a full 3 hours to write the exam. So if you go to the next slide, this has got a screenshot of what it looks like, what one of the questions looks like. It's not really clear, but when you go through the exam, first of all, they take a snapshot of you, and your picture is up in the corner. And that's just to make sure that the person sitting at that computer is the same person that's supposed to be writing that exam. There's only one question that will come up before you at a time. You have a choice of an answer A, B, C, or D. You can either click on the letter, you can type it in, you have the option of doing either. If you click on it, it will put the letter in the box at the bottom, or you can go to the box at the bottom and type it in, whatever you're most comfortable with. You can change the answer as many times as you want. You can go back to a question as many times as you want. You can do whatever you want with those questions until you hit the submit at the final, at the end of the exam. So if you have a question you're not really too sure of it, what I did was I took my pencil and I wrote the number of that question on the piece of scrap paper that they gave me, and then I was able to go back to that question once I had finished all the questions and spend some more time on it. Just from experience and from the teaching experience I've had, if you come to a question and you're really stumped on it, skip it. Go past it. Go on to another question. You don't have to answer question 6 before you move to question 7. Write 6 down so that you know you have to go back and answer that question and move on to other questions. Don't spend a lot of time on one question or you may end up running out of time. I have heard of some people who did run out of time and didn't have a chance to answer all the questions. So again, you can use the forward arrow to move to the next question, or you can type in the number of the next question. You can do whatever you want, whatever you're most comfortable with to get you to the next question. If you go to the next slide, the content outline. We talked about a couple slides ago about the content outline. Content outline is basically what I like to refer to as a syllabus of study. It breaks the expected knowledge down into, I believe there's 7 different sections. And each section, if you'll notice on the slide here, I've got a number behind it in brackets. That is the number of questions out of the 150 that are allotted to that topic. So, for example, are you going to spend as much time on education that has 12 questions as you would on perhaps infection prevention and control that has 36 questions? It will help you allocate your study time, and it'll give you some idea as to what importance they've given each section. The questions are a varying degree of difficulty. You may have an easy question around education, and you may have a difficult question around education. They try to mix it up a little bit so that they're not all easy questions, they're not all hard questions. Each area that they've broken it down to will, in the handbook that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, in that handbook, it will give you a current list of references that you can use to answer, to give you the knowledge that you need for that section. So the content outline is important. What I've got on here is the 2009 content outline. It may change slightly for 2010. I don't believe they've put the 2010 outline out yet. I will check and see if they have, but as of Friday of last week anyway, they were still using the 2009 content outline. So this gives you an idea of the sections, the areas that they expect you to have knowledge in. Identification of infectious disease processes, that is actually all the microbiology stuff that you need to know. Surveillance and epidemiological investigation, infection prevention and control, program management and communication, education, and infection control aspects of employee health. And those are the 7 sections that you need to have knowledge of. So if you go to the next slide, it's just basically a title slide that talks about resources. And what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about some of the resources that you're going to need or that will be really helpful to you if you're getting ready to write this exam. So if you move on to the next slide, the very first one that I put in here is titled the CIBIC, or Certification Board of Infection Control and Epidemiology Handbook. This is it's probably the most important thing that you can have. It's a really great source of information. It's going to outline everything that you need to know for the exam. It gives you the outline that we just talked about. It talks about all of the things you need. It basically gives you a syllabus of study or of expected knowledge for the exam. It provides details on the education and practice requirements that we talked about. We talked about them very briefly in two or three slides, but it's actually got pages of what you need to know and what you need to actually have to fulfill the requirements for the exam. You can get a hard copy by contacting the certification board through the website, or you can actually download it from the website. What you download is exactly the same as what you will get if they send it to you, except when they send it to you, it's going to be on glossy paper. And when you download it, it's going to be printed on whatever paper you have on your printer. And that's the only difference. It is probably the most important piece of resource material that you can have. It's going to list all of the reference documents or books or whatever you will need to have the knowledge that you need to write the exam. So it's the most important thing. And if you're thinking about getting certified, or if you're not even sure, you're not sure what you need to do or what you need to have, download this. It's free. You just go to the website and download it, and it will give you all the information you're going to need. Then if you go to the next slide, what I've got listed here is the APIC text, and I apologize, I've got a picture here of the last edition, the second edition. There's now a third edition that's available, but this was the only picture I had, so that's why I put it on here. The APIC text is probably your primary study tool. When I was studying for this exam, I used it as my number one resource. It's got everything in it that you will need to know. I did say that CIBIC and APIC are not connected, and they are not connected, but a lot of the information that the certification board requires is contained in this textbook. You need access to this textbook if you're getting ready to write your exam, whether you get it through your employer, whether you borrow it from a borrowing library or someplace. You need to have access to this textbook. APIC has actually made it much easier to get access to this textbook. To purchase it, it's quite expensive. It's about, I believe, $400 or $500 to purchase the textbook, which in the picture here showed three volumes. It's now two volumes, but it's still as thick. So it's quite expensive to purchase an actual printed copy, but if you have access to the printed copy, it's great. You have to have access to it. They now have, and I think it's absolutely wonderful, they have a searchable online version of this APIC text. This has just been launched in the last few months. It is actually quite affordable. It's if you are an APIC member, it's $99 a year for access to this. If you're not an APIC member, it's $149 a year, but that's still quite reasonable to have unlimited access to the number one resource for infection prevention and control. The online version is searchable. It will be regularly updated, and you can access it from any computer anywhere as long as you have internet access. You are given a passcode, and that's what you use to access it. It's a web-based access, so you can access it from anywhere. There's really no excuse for people not having access to the APIC text anymore. And it is really the number one resource that you should have in your facility or your organization anyway, if you have someone responsible for infection prevention and control. If you have purchased already the third edition, the newest edition, as a print version, you get 1 year of free access online to the online version. And it will have the code with it when you purchase it. So anybody who has the printed version also has online version as well. If you go to the next slide, the APIC study guide, and again, I want to emphasize the fact that this is a study guide that is put out by APIC, not the certification board. It is not a product from the certification board, and the questions that are in it are not indicative of the questions that you will come in contact with on the exam itself. It will help you identify gaps in your knowledge, but the questions are not necessarily representative of exam questions. This certification study guide is being updated this year to reflect content changes as a result of the new practice analysis. So if you are thinking of buying one, my suggestion would be hold off for a couple of months and see if the new version is out. It is written by Christine Nutty, who is the author, and she is very accessible. And if you have questions about anything you come across in this study guide, you can email Christine and she will happily share the rationale for the answers or references for the answers, or if you can show why her answer is incorrect, she's happy to change the answers as well. So it's a good study tool, but it's important to remember that it is not a CIBIC product and it does not necessarily represent what you're going to run into on the exam. If you move to the next slide, it's labeled titled Practice Exam. The Certification Board, and this is the one product that the Certification Board has put out, it is basically a practice exam is exactly what they say it is. It's a 70-question online exam that's set up almost exactly the same way as the actual exam that you can purchase. It's $50 U.S. to purchase this exam. And you can purchase it through the CIBIC website. And it will give you a feel for the questions and the computer and the way the questions are worded and what have you prior to actually writing the exam. Once you pay your $50, you have unlimited access 24 hours a day for 60 days from the time you purchase it. So for 2 months, once you've paid your $50 for 2 months, you can go in and out of it as many times as you want, as often as you want, to go through it. Once you've actually answered a question and submitted it, you can't go back and change your answers. But it will provide you a little bit of rationale of why the answer that you gave was correct or incorrect. I found it quite helpful with people that we've been working with to write this practice exam before they actually write the exam. If you move to the next slide, APIC, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control in the U.S., has an online certification review course. This is a course that you can access. It's $295 U.S. You have unlimited access to it. And it's intended for people who meet the practice requirements, who meet the education requirements, who just want sort of a review before they actually write the exam. It's important to note that, again, this is not endorsed by CIBIC. It does not necessarily reflect the content of the exam. It give you a good review. It's a good review course, but you still need to go ahead and study on your own and follow the content outlined for the exam from the handbook to make sure that you have everything you need before you write the exam. And it's also important to remember that even taking this course, like we said earlier, there is no course that is actually going to prepare you to write the exam. You actually have to spend some time studying on your own. So if you move to the next slide, this is just a picture of some other really valuable resources that are out there that are available. There's the American Journal of Infection Control, the Canadian Journal of Infection Control. APIC has a book out called The Ready Reference, which I like to refer to as the Cliff Notes or the Cole's Notes for the APIC text. It's sort of an abbreviated version, but it gives you a quick overview. Control of Communicable Diseases Manual by Heyman is a very valuable resource. You also need to review current standards and guidelines and journals, that type of thing. But there's a complete list of reference materials in that candidate handbook that CIBIC puts out for you to use. So we're going to spend the next couple of minutes, I see we're almost out of time, but talking about some hints and tips. If you get the chance, set up a study group. If there are other people who are getting ready to write the exam, get together. It really helps to bounce ideas and questions off other people. We've had great success with study groups in Ontario. If you don't know of anybody who's writing the exam, perhaps you can use your CHICA chapter or your APIC chapter to help find potential candidates to help you set up a study group. They are very valuable, very helpful. If you go to the next slide, there are just some quick, helpful hints. Don't write before you're ready. Don't allow someone to push you into writing the exam because they think you're ready. If you don't feel ready, you're not ready. Take your time. Make sure that you feel ready, you feel you've covered what you need to before you write the exam. It is still based on 2 years' knowledge, so make sure that they don't expect you to write it as soon as you start a new job in infection prevention and control. If you can, spend some time with an ICP in a different setting. If you work in a hospital, see if you can spend some time with someone in a long-term care facility. Or if you don't have a dialysis unit, perhaps you can go someplace and spend some time with a dialysis unit or in a hospital that has a big ICU with people on ventilators. try to spend some time, if you can, in another setting, because it will help you, because the exam is based on all settings. And again, your Chica chapter or APIC chapter may be able to help you set this up. Exam tips: be comfortable with that computer. Use those practice questions. If you move to the next slide, use those questions to make sure that you're comfortable before you move into your timed period. Reread the questions. Don't speed read and think you know the answer. Read them and reread them. Try to think about how that is applicable in your practice setting, and that'll give you an idea of how you're going to answer the question. Try to relate it, like I said, to your practice setting. Don't change your answers. If I can say one thing, your first instinct is almost always right. Don't change your answers. Don't think you're wrong unless you actually know for a fact that you're wrong by answering a question later on, or something later on triggers you and you can go back and change that answer. 9 times out of 10, if you change your answer, you change it from the correct answer to an incorrect answer. So don't change your answers unless you're absolutely sure that you were wrong. Go to the next slide. Book your exam, set out your study schedule, and get ready. A lot of people work better under pressure. Set that date. Set it 30 days down the road. Give yourself 30 days and spend those 30 days studying. If you don't work good under pressure, then give yourself the time that you need. Get a group together. You may work on your own, whichever works best for you. Make sure that you cover the content that's set out in the course outline and that you're comfortable with it before you write your exam. Unless you work really well under pressure and you like getting asked questions, don't tell anybody that you're writing the exam, because you will get asked, have you written yet? Have you heard yet? Have you written yet? And another hint, just from personal experience, don't have your boss looking over your shoulder when you open your exam results either, because that's a little bit of pressure. But enjoy the process. It's really not as difficult as I've made it sound. If I can pass this exam, anybody who can sit and study some books can pass this exam, but make sure you've got the practice requirements as well, because you need to understand the process. You need to understand what's going on around you in the field of infection prevention and control to be able to write this exam. And last but not least, celebrate your success. Once you've passed this exam, let people know. It's a good accomplishment. There are only just over 400 people who hold certifications. So we're an elite group, and worldwide I don't have any idea what the numbers are, but it means that you have mastered a body of knowledge. You should be proud of yourself and celebrate your successes. And Paul, I will turn it back over to you. I see we're just a couple minutes over time.
That's all right, Sue. Thank you very much. That was a tremendous presentation, and I agree that it is indeed an achievement worth celebration. Folks, I thank you very much for joining us. Sue, thank you. You put a lot of work into this, and as always, you did it in a very professional way. I thank you very, very much for that.
You're welcome, Paul.
So we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.
Thanks.